Well, I'm not going to say anything more about this slide 13, because I've already talked about it, and it's just a summary slide anyway. Slide 14 looks very similar, but the important thing here is to mention the importance of calcium ions, Ca2+, as signal molecules. Several signal pathways use calcium ions in various ways as signal molecules. Since it's in various ways, that means the same calcium ions can cause many different effects depending on how they operate. So calcium ions can enter the cytosol, first of all, in two different ways. They can come from the extracellular fluid through an ion channel. That's what you're seeing up at the top there. Or they can be released into the cytosol from an intracellular structure called the endoplasmic reticulum, which has various functions, but one function of the endoplasmic reticulum is to sequester and house calcium ions, thereby keeping them out of the general cytosol. All right? So that's what's happening here on calcium release from intracellular calcium stores. However they get there, though, calcium ions work by binding to proteins of various sorts. And there's two basic classes of proteins they bind to. One is a molecule called calmodulin, which is listed separately because it's pretty important. Many pathways use calmodulin. And the basic scheme of operation for calmodulin, as you see, is that once it is activated by binding to calcium ions, the activated calmodulin then can alter various kinds of proteins. It depends on which cell it's in. And often the proteins that they alter are enzymes. So once again, you're activating or deactivating an enzyme and thereby turning on or off a biochemical pathway to have the actual effect. But calcium ions can also bind to other calcium ion binding proteins, which usually are involved in some sort of movement. Exocytosis, of course, is movement or transport of some large packet of material from a vesicle that's inside the cell to the extracellular fluid. That's what exocytosis is. Or calcium ions can be involved in movement of microfilaments. This is particularly true, for instance, in skeletal muscle tissue. Skeletal muscle cells are able to contract because of the interaction between two proteins called actin and myosin. That is allowed to occur because of calcium ions binding to another protein called troponin. So that's what actually calcium ions are absolutely required for your muscle cells to contract. That's just an example. So a pretty important and versatile chemical signal, calcium ions. Slide 15 gives yet another cartoon representation of something that I've mentioned before, and that is that a receptor site on a receptor protein has specificity, but specificity is not absolute. So there might be more than one type of ligand that is properly shaped enough to fit into that receptor site. Well, there's usually one I don't want to use the word intended, but it makes sense to say intended, that there's one ligand that is called the primary ligand that is what usually binds to that receptor. But there could be something else that has enough of the right shape, and it could be either an agonist or an antagonist. An agonist, well, those words are opposites of each other, for one thing. Agonists work in the same way as the primary ligand. So an agonist will actually cause the same response. It will mimic the action of the primary ligand. An antagonist, on the other hand, when binding to that receptor site, will cause some sort of conformational change, as you would expect, but it doesn't cause the correct conformational change for there to be the correct response. So in other words, it just basically blocks that receptor. And that's the whole essence of competition. All right? So pharmaceutical companies exploit this in order to make both agonists and antagonists. They want to design agonists if the patient does not make enough of the primary hormone, for instance, on their own. Their bodies don't make enough, then you exogenously put in an agonist that's designed because of its shape, and it might have the same effect. On the other hand, if there's too much being endogenously created, meaning within the body naturally, then an antagonist can block receptors and thereby blunt the effect of the overproduction of the hormone in the patient. Slide 16 is an illustration of the fact that the same chemical signal, the same ligand, can have totally different effects, in fact, antagonistic effects, opposite effects, in different tissues. And the reason that this is possible is simply because it's not the chemical signal that determines what the response is. All the chemical signal does is bind to any receptor that allows it to bind to it, and then its job is done. The specific effect that occurs, the response, just depends on what that receptor is. So different tissues might have totally different proteins that have receptor sites for the same ligand. So a hormone will work one way on one tissue and a completely different way on another tissue. As you see here, this example is blood vessels in different places will either be vasodilated, increased in diameter, or vasoconstricted, reduced in diameter, in response to the same exact hormone, epinephrine. Slide 17 gives you a basic scheme for a control system. We've already been talking a lot about control systems. But the reason these things are called control systems is because they control something. Well, the thing they control, as you see, are regulated variables. A lot of books use the word parameter instead of regulated variable. As a math nerd and stickler, I don't really like that terminology. Regulated variable is better because technically it's really not a parameter. But you'll see that terminology. It's a variable because it's something that can vary. It can change in value. Well, these regulated variables are the various things that need to be homeostatically maintained. Things like pH, body temperature, blood pressure, there's a whole host of things. If those things are within the desired range, meaning if there is not much of a difference between the set point and the actual value, which means there isn't much of an error, then nothing is done. No change needs to be made. But that only happens graphically when the thing is right in the middle of the desired range. But if an error of an unacceptable magnitude occurs, if there is a big enough difference between the actual value and the set point, then some sensor tells an integrating sensor that that is the case. So there has to be a sensor, as I mentioned. It has to be something measuring that variable at any given moment. The integrating center is whatever cell does the comparison. The integrating center houses that set point. If it learns that there is a big difference between the set point and the variable, then the integrating center sends out a signal to an effector. Effectors couldn't be just about anything. There are other cells. Effectors are the tissues that have to be changed in some way in order for that variable to get back to a value that's closer to set point. All right? So they can be just individual cells. In the case of control systems involving the nervous system, effectors receptors are muscles or glands in general. But control systems don't need to involve the nervous system. They can involve the endocrine system. Those are the two major control organ systems. But control systems can be as simple as just populations of cells. Okay, in any case, this is the scheme by which they work. And what kind of feedback is this? It's negative feedback, because negative feedback negates the error and brings it back to set point. Slide 18 is something we haven't talked about at all. This illustrates the notion of one of the two kinds of control that can be exerted. This is called tonic control, just like in gin and tonic. Tonic is the adjective of tone in this case, and tone refers to the output of something, in this case a nerve, because you have neurons here. In tonic control, there is a single cell, a single kind of cell, that is controlling the variable. And so by just changing the output of that neuron, the effector is changed. This is kind of like, kind of like a dimmer switch, I guess. You use a single switch to control a light with a dimmer switch, but you can turn it up or down, right? By changing the output or the value of the knob. This is how the nervous system works. This is one way in which the nervous system works, as you see. So a neuron can modulate or adjust the frequency of its output, the frequency of its action potentials, which is its signals that it sends. And that change in frequency will cause a difference in the response of the effector. Okay, and the frequency is illustrated in these little graphs. Frequency is amount of, in this case, action potentials in a given amount of time, how frequently it happens. So the higher frequency means on a graph they're spaced closer together. It's a higher frequency down here, it's a lower frequency down here. The reason that neurons have to operate by adjusting their frequency rather than their amplitude, which would be how high it goes on the graph, how high those action potentials are, is that action potentials, which we'll have much more to say about later, are all the same magnitude. That's why all of these little spikes are the same height on this graph. Since they're all the same magnitude, there's no such thing as strong or weak action potentials, and therefore a neuron has to encode a strong stimulus as a higher frequency of action potentials. That's tonic control. There's one neuron doing the job of turning it both up or down. That's different from antagonistic control, which is shown in slide 19. Antagonistic refers to things working against each other. And so there are two neurons involved in an antagonistic control system. One that can turn things up, one that can turn things down. And so you see, for instance, that the heart operates this way in this example. There are two branches of the nervous system, two branches actually of the motor nervous system, which itself is a branch of the peripheral nervous system, which is itself a branch of the central, of the overall nervous system. Anyway, the motor nervous system is broken down into the somatic motor nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system is the part of the nervous system that controls things behind the scenes, things you don't have to think about, like your heartbeat. You don't have to remember to beat your heart. That's taken care of automatically. Well, there are two branches of the autonomic nervous system called the sympathetic division and the parasympathetic division that, if the neurons making up those divisions both innervate or connect to the same target tissue, in this case the heart, In other words, if a tissue is dually innervated by both branches, then those branches in general work against each other. They work antagonistically. In the case of, it depends on what the tissue, the target tissue is, by the way, as to which one turns things up and which one turns things down. In the specific case of the heart, it's the sympathetic division that turns it up. It's the parasympathetic division that turns it down. Okay, so that's the idea of antagonistic control. You have two different cells, one doing the opposite of the other. Okay, now for a brief description of receptors, slide 20. Be careful with the word receptors, because as you see here, as in the case of a lot of vocabulary within biology, it can be used different ways. So receptors, as I've been using it mostly in these last couple lectures, can refer to proteins that have receptor sites, proteins that act as receptors for ligands. But receptors also can refer to specialized groups of cells or even highly specialized organs, like the eye, for instance, that are adapted to receiving some sort of stimulus and transducing that stimulus into some sort of signal. So the special sense organs, as they're called, are listed under central receptors here. Central receptors are sensory receptors that are located in the head, basically, close to the brain. That's why they get the name central. You see these in the eyes, the ears, the nose, and the tongue. Now, you were probably taught in grade school that there are five senses. First of all, that's not true. There are more than five senses. It is true that there are five special senses. You were probably told that the five were vision, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. Is that true? Is that what you were taught? Touch is a sense, but it's not a special sense, because special senses are located in highly localized regions, all in the head, basically. You can touch with your feet, with any part of your skin has taction, which is the sense of touch. So it is a general sense, but there are still receptors, of course, that need to be able to respond to being touched, which respond to those stimuli. Those, though, are classified as peripheral receptors. They lie outside of the head, scattered throughout the body. And you have some that are superficial in your skin, and fewer that are deeper. So you're not really aware of your viscera too much. Your spleen doesn't itch, for instance. It's just in there working. But those are peripheral receptors. And the bottom row of this slide shows you functional classifications of various receptors, no matter whether they're found in special sense organs or just general sense organs. Chemoreceptors get their name from the fact that they respond to the presence of specific kinds of chemicals. Osmoreceptors to osmolarity. Thermoreceptors to temperature, of course. Now, baro means pressure, hence the word barometer, which measures the atmospheric pressure, will respond to pressure in various ways. Proprioceptors are, or proprioceptors as this book calls them, proprioception is the sensory input of information about the placement of the various body parts. So your brain is continuously aware of where all your pieces are at any given time, which is important, whether you're aware of it or not. That's an important point. Sensory input does not necessarily mean sensation. Sensation is sensory input that becomes apparent to you. Sensations are things that you're aware of. They're conscious perception. Sensory input of all other sorts, though, happens behind the scenes. For instance, you can't feel your blood pressure, but your brain knows what it is. That's not sensation. Okay, just the general word mechanoreceptors refers to any sort of receptor that responds in some way to some sort of deformation of a tissue. So So when things get squeezed, pushed, vibrated, whatever, mechanoreceptors will be involved. This is how your ears work, for instance. There are mechanoreceptors that get deformed when the sound pressure wave moves things around in your inner ear, in the cochlea. All right, I haven't said much about reflexes, if anything. Slide 21 gives you the little flow chart for what a reflex is, the steps in a reflex. A reflex is a control pathway that is comparatively long distance, meaning that it's not just a cell controlling itself or a cell right next to it. There is some sort of distance involved. But you still have these basic steps that you have to have a stimulus and then a series of events that leads to a response. What is a stimulus? A stimulus is an event or a condition about either the internal environment or the external environment. So being touched, for instance, is an event. That stimulus might or might not be of the right type or the right magnitude to cause whatever sensor the stimulus is applied to have any response. For instance, you can touch yourself and tell you're touching yourself by looking at it lightly, so lightly that you can't yet feel it. So just because there's a stimulus doesn't mean that all of these steps are going to be followed. It has to be a sufficiently strong stimulus for the sensor to be activated. But there, of course, has to be a sensor to respond. And the afferent pathway, that word afferent, means coming toward. It's the opposite of efferent, which is spelled identically except for the initial. Efferent means going away from. So in this sense, afferent means moving toward the integration center, which can be as simple as the cell, or it is some sort of cell somewhere. Could be in the brain, could be the spinal cord, or it could be just an endocrine cell, for instance. But it's some sort of cell that receives the information through the afferent pathway, and if appropriate, will cause some sort of output. That output is a signal that is sent through the efferent pathway in order to get to whatever cell needs to be changed. Okay, whatever cell needs to be changed is the target or the effector, as I mentioned earlier. And when the effector receives that signal, that effector is changed in some way. Well, that change is the response. And in a reflex, these reflexes work by negative feedback. Therefore, reflexes are homeostatic. So the response is an appropriate change in the right direction in order to try to undo whatever the error was that the stimulus represents. So graphically, it looks like slide 22. The allowable range is that bluish shaded region. Nothing is controlled perfectly. There's no regulated variable that stays ruler flat. There always is a little bit of error, except for the instantaneous times when the line crosses the red line. But that almost never happens. The point is, as I've mentioned before, that there is some allowance for error. It's just when the error gets big enough, then that represents a stimulus that is big enough to cause all of those parts of the pathway we just looked at to be activated, and therefore a response will bring things back toward the set point. Now, slide 23, splits, it gives you the difference between negative feedback and positive feedback in schematic form. We've already mentioned the big difference. Positive feedback can never lead to homeostasis, and that's simply because positive feedback always exacerbates whatever error is measured. It makes it worse. It moves the regulated variable even farther away from set point, from what it was a moment ago. That can never lead to homeostasis. And because of that, positive feedback mechanisms always have to be temporary, either by killing you, in which case it's no longer operating, or by being supplanted, taken over by some negative feedback mechanism. Okay? So that's what this whole idea of an outside factor being required to shut off feedback cycle is all about. They can't be, positive feedback mechanisms cannot be allowed to continue indefinitely, in other words. Well, I already gave you the familiar example shown in 24 of parturition, childbirth, being a positive feedback mechanism. It's one of the so-called normal positive feedback mechanisms. It's not the only one, but you just hopefully it makes sense to you that it's a positive feedback mechanism. The head of the fetus toward the time of birth starts to descend in the uterus. The opening between the uterus and the vagina is the cervix. That gets stretched by the skull as the fetus descends. That stretch is sensed by stretch receptors in the muscle. Those stretch receptors, by the way, are specific examples of mechanoreceptors because they're being deformed. That sends signals to the brain in the form of action potentials. The brain responds by releasing a neurohormone called oxytocin from the posterior pituitary or neurohypophysis. That oxytocin, since it's a neurohormone, like any hormone, is going to travel through the bloodstream, get back to the uterus, specifically the superior part of the uterus, the fundus, which causes the smooth muscle lining that fundus to contract. The contraction of that muscle squeezes the feet, the foot end of the fetus, the top in this case, because normally a fetus is upside down. And so that pushes it closer toward the vagina, which makes the head stretch the cervix even more. So now even a stronger stretch stimulus is sent to the brain. It releases more oxytocin and so on until, if all things go correctly, the kid pops out. And so that's a temporary positive feedback mechanism that is not pathological. But it's soon after, as soon as the kid emerges, then you're back to negative feedback mechanisms that restore homeostasis. Well, now 25 just gives you an overview of reflexes of different types. So the two main controls, organ systems, entire organ systems that work for as control systems, as I've mentioned, are the nervous system and the endocrine system. Well, you can have a simple endocrine reflex which does not involve the nervous system at all. So notice that in a simple endocrine reflex, there's no afferent pathway. And that's because endocrine cells in a simple endocrine reflex are sensing, they're doing their own job of sensing whatever it is that the stimulus is, that they're sensing the stimulus by themselves. They don't have to send that information anywhere. They are the integrating center, those endocrine cells. But they do respond with an efferent signal. In the case of the endocrine system, that efferent signal is a hormone. Since hormones, by definition, are chemical signals that make their way into the bloodstream, efferent signals are broadcast throughout the body, as I've mentioned. So they're not targeted specifically. They're not sent specifically to their targets. They're just put out there, and they'll find their targets. But what makes something a target of an endocrine signal? Anything that just happens to have the correctly shaped receptor on its surface, which could be many different kinds of tissues, and therefore that same signal can have many different kinds of effects in different parts of the body. All of the cells that don't have the proper receptors will just not respond at all because they are, by definition, not targets of that signal, even though they'll receive the signal. Okay, a simple neural reflex, of course, involves the nervous system. That's why it's a neural reflex. And so there is an afferent pathway in a neural reflex. There has to be some sort of receptor cell, which could, in the simplest case, be a neuron itself, just a raw nerve ending. But it could be a specialized cell that's associated with a neuron. In any case, there has to be a neuron involved serving as the afferent pathway. There has to be a cell that conducts the action potential that is the afferent signal that sends it to the integrating center. In the case of neural reflexes, that integrating center is some part of the central nervous system. The central nervous system consists of the brain and spinal cord. So it doesn't necessarily involve the brain, but it has to involve either the brain or the spinal cord. And then there needs to be an efferent pathway, which is another neuron. That neuron will send action potential away from the central nervous system, and therefore that's why it's efferent, to whatever the appropriate effector is. But in this case, notice that these neural signals are highly targeted, highly localized. Those are sent to just the effector and nowhere else, because neurons innervate or synapse with individual cells. So that individual cell, which could be another neuron, or it could be a gland cell, or it could be a muscle cell, whatever that individual target cell is the only thing that's receiving the signal from that individual efferent neuron. And what is the signal in the case of an efferent neuron? What is it that the neuron is releasing? A neurotransmitter. Right. That's in the case of a simple neural reflex. Now there's a combination of the two, and that's what's shown in the rightmost one. A neuroendocrine reflex involves both control organ systems. So it starts out exactly the same as you see as a simple neural reflex, meaning that there is an afferent neuron sending a signal to some part of the central nervous system. Then the efferent neuron, in this case, might be releasing a neurohormone. So in the case of the release of a neurohormone, you're now involving endocrine control, because even though that's a highly localized efferent signal that's coming out of the brain or spinal cord, when it releases its when it releases its signal, the neurohormone, it's put into the bloodstream, and then it's no longer localized. Okay? It still could have specific effects, though, because it might be only one type of tissue that has the receptors for that hormone. In any case, it involves both systems. And this can be longer than it even shows. In other words, it shows here a second efferent signal, the hormone, going to an effector. Well, it could be that the second efferent hormone travels somewhere and causes another endocrine cell to release still another hormone, which then goes through the bloodstream to another place. So it can be a whole series of events. This is an example. I mean, what makes it complex is the fact that there are multiple efferent signals. Okay? Notice that in all these cases, though, even for the complex, there's only one afferent signal. 26 is a similar slide, but it gives you specific examples. Actually, not so specific examples. It gives you kind of more of an anatomical description. I don't think I have to go through these exhaustively, but notice that the neuroendocrine reflexes 3, 4, and 5 are of increasing complexity. And number 5 actually does happen quite often. We'll talk about specific examples of that later, but this is what I just was talking about on the last slide. The central nervous system can release a neurohormone. That neurohormone can travel to an endocrine target cell that will release another hormone that will go to another kind of endocrine target cell that will release still another hormone. And then finally, the ultimate target is reached to have the ultimate response. slides 27 and 28 are tables, and I generally don't read tables to you because you can do that for yourself. But I include them here to let you know that this stuff is important. I've covered a lot of this anyway, but tables are good things to look at while you're studying because it includes a lot of important information in a small space. So it's a pretty efficient way of studying. But I'm not going to read these to you. It compares the neural and endocrine control and compares the various reflexes. So that's that chapter. Are there any questions before I go to chapter 7, which is related to chapter 6? It's just specifically descriptive of the endocrine system rather than just control systems in general. Nothing? Okay. Well, chapter 7, slide 1 starts right out with another table. And even though I'm not going to read this to you, I do want to mention something about it. Notice that it's comparing peptide, steroid, and amino acid-derived hormones. We've already talked about how different chemicals act differently as signals based on their hydrophobicity, right? Things that are hydrophobic don't enter the cell. And those, in general, are lipid-based hormones. Well, I like to break hormones, and now we're specifically talking about hormones at this point because we're in the endocrine system. We're not talking about other kinds of chemical signals. But there are two, as far as I'm concerned, there are two broad classes of hormones. Those are the lipid-based and the amino acid-based. Now, amino acid-based includes peptide hormones and amino acid-derived hormones. What is the difference between the two? Well, peptide bonds are bonds between amino acids. So a single amino acid, or an amino acid that is just slightly changed, is not a peptide, technically, because it's only one part. It takes at least two amino acids to form a peptide bond. If you have a lot of amino acids, then it's called a polypeptide. If you have a hell of a lot of amino acids strung together, then it's called a protein. But in all of those cases, one amino acid or more, it's amino acid based, right? That's why I think it makes sense to just think of that as a broad class. Because functionally, all of those amino acid based hormones with almost without exception are hydrophilic, meaning that they dissolve in water but do not like to cannot cross the plasma membrane. Alright? Whereas lipid-based ones are able to. But that's why this book separates it into three, because peptides are larger than amino acid-derived hormones. Notice, though, also that the amino acid derivatives, a derivative is just something that is slightly changed in some way. So an amino acid is changed slightly to form these amino acid derivatives. Notice, though, that they are tyrosine derivatives, meaning that it's not just any amino acid that serves as hormones for these amino acid derivatives. It specifically is tyrosine that is changed in one way or another to give rise to these two broad classes, catecholamines and the thyroid hormones. Now, speaking of the thyroid hormones, that is an exception. The thyroid hormones, which include T3 and T4, you see T4 down here is called thyroxine, that's one of its names. T4 stands for tetraiodothyronine, T3 stands for triiodothyronine. And that's why, since there's two of them, that's why we call them the thyroid hormones. Anyway, even though they're amino acid derivatives, they are lipophilic. That's what makes them exceptional. So the thyroid hormones, even though they're amino acid based, are able to go right through the phospholipid bilayer of the plasma membrane. and therefore they operate the same way that lipid-based hormones do. It's an exception, though. Now, slide 2 is a slightly confusing picture, in my opinion, because it tries to put simultaneously explain too many things. But what I want you to know from this is that there are such things as pre-pro hormones and pro hormones, and of course, just hormones. But the pre-pro hormones are what are actually translated at the ribosome. So it's the first thing that's made. Now, pro means before, and pre means before. So this is doubly early, this pre-pro hormone, meaning it's not ready yet to be used. Pre-pro hormones are proteins that are made that include the stuff that is going to make the activated hormone, but it also includes other peptides, other stretches of amino acids. Plus, importantly, it includes a signal sequence. That signal sequence is itself a chain of amino acids. It's all part of the protein. But that signal protein tells the cell that this is a pre-pro hormone and tells it how to deal with it. It allows it into the signal protein is a little stretch of amino acids that allows this pre-pro hormone to be transported into the endoplasmic reticulum, which then does the job of processing it. Okay, so not all hormones start out as pre-pro hormones, but some do. It's not a pre-pro hormone unless it has this signal sequence, though, is the main point here, definitionally. Pro hormones can be either made directly at the ribosome or they can result from modification of a pre-pro hormone. But a pro hormone is, no matter what the origin, is still not ready. It's still not the active form of the hormone because it includes these other peptide fragments. Okay? So these, don't worry about these words like pro-opio-melanocortin. That's just a specific example. I just want you to realize the difference between these words. In any case, once a pro-hormone is processed by removing those extraneous peptides, the things that are not supposed to be there as far as the hormone is concerned, then what is left is one or possibly more hormones. That's what you see in slide B, or in part B of the slide, is a pro-hormone, once it's processed, can give rise to multiple hormones. But in any case, after the processing of a pro-hormone, what you have left are the activated hormone, shown just in blue. So the specific example down here, you have pro-insulin, as the name implies, that is the pro-hormone version of insulin. It's not able to operate as the hormone insulin yet until you strip off the magenta part, the C-peptide. Now that C-peptide generally doesn't do anything. It's not always called a C-peptide. That other peptide fragment that's taken off generally doesn't do anything. It certainly doesn't act as a hormone. But that doesn't mean we can't use it. In the case of proinsulin, once that C-peptide is stripped off, it can be found and tested for as a way of measuring how much insulin a suspected diabetic is making. Without actually measuring insulin, you can measure C-peptide, which signals insulin production. Because insulin is continuously being used. If it's there, it's going to be used. This C-peptide hangs around because it's not doing anything. It won't hang around forever, but it's a good marker. Anyway, insulin itself is the activated hormone then. Now, slide 3 should look familiar to you. It looks pretty much identical to several of the slides in chapter 6. But now we're just specifically talking about hormones. Well, hormones themselves, if they are hydrophilic, what's the other word for hydrophilic? Lipophobic, good. Then they can't enter the cell and therefore have to operate via surface receptors. Well, hormones are chemical signals, and they therefore can activate second messenger systems. And the general scheme for second messenger systems is that there is often a phosphorylation step. And I mentioned what phosphorylation is, right, last time. Phosphorylation is simply tacking on a phosphate to something. Well, that's a big deal because a lot of molecules either will or will not operate with a phosphate. So don't think that phosphorylation necessarily turns something on. It doesn't necessarily activate things. There are some proteins that act as enzymes, for instance, that will be enzymes unless they're attached to a phosphate. In other words, phosphorylation can turn an enzyme on or off. And it's not always enzymes. These proteins in the blue box here could be any kind of protein, but very often the proteins are acting as enzymes. And that's important because enzymes catalyze biochemical reactions. And if you can turn on an enzyme or off, then you turn on or off that specific reaction that might be part of a long pathway. But if you turn off one step within a pathway, you effectively shut down the whole pathway. And that gives the cell exquisite control over its own biochemistry just by manipulating enzymes. That's why hormones are so powerful in their effect. By the way, the reason that they're so powerful from the standpoint of concentration, meaning that there doesn't have to be very high concentration of hormone in the blood for there to be a big effect, is because of the cascade effect, because of the amplification that is noticed in each step in the signal transduction pathway. And that's particularly true for hormones that bind to surface receptors, because those are the ones that have multiple steps compared to lipophilic hormones that operate via what mechanism? What, in general, what do lipophilic hormones do? Right, they either bind to a receptor in the nucleus, in the nucleoplasm, or they bind to a receptor in the cytoplasm, but in either case, that hormone receptor complex is going to make its way into the nucleus, and the effect of that is to activate genes. So there aren't as many steps involved in that, but so there isn't as much amplification, I guess, is what I'm saying. Slide 4 shows you that the steroid hormones, which are lipid hormones, a class of hormones called the steroid hormones, all have one thing in common. They all come from, are made out of, cholesterol. Cholesterol is shown on the top. Don't memorize this formula, but it just shows you that when you look at their structural formulae, these little drawings, they look very similar because they all came from cholesterol. And so, in general, I won't say that yet. Steroid hormones, though, are comparatively few in number. Most of the hormones in your body are amino acid-based hormones. And they are produced in specific glands that you can actually see and point to and say that is an endocrine gland, but they can be produced just by single cells scattered throughout the rest of the organ systems. Those would make up what is called the diffuse endocrine system. The endocrine system that, as we talk about it, is really consists of highly specialized glands like the thyroid gland. So amino acid-based hormones are made many places. Steroid hormones really only come from a couple places, well, three. They're manufactured by and released from the gonads, which in males are the testes. What's the singular of testes? Testis, right, not testy. That's T-E-S-T-I-S. Those are the gonads of males. The gonads of females are ovaries. So both of those devices produce steroid hormones. The other place in any body that produces steroid hormones are the adrenal glands, specifically the adrenal cortices. Cortices is the plural of cortex. What, by the way, does cortex mean? What is a cortex? Right, cortex, good, is a comparatively superficial part of a structure. So certain structures have a cortex and a medulla. The cortex is the superficial part, the medulla is the deeper part. The adrenal glands are an example of that. There's an adrenal cortex and adrenal medulla. The adrenal cortex does something entirely different from the adrenal cortex. The adrenal cortex actually makes amino acid-based hormones, whereas the adrenal medulla does, whereas the adrenal cortex makes steroid hormones, including aldosterone, which is shown right there on the left, and cortisol, actually. So everyone has either a gonad or an adrenal gland. The third place, though, that steroid hormones are produced is in the placenta, which not everyone has. Certainly no men, and only some women, just pregnant women. And that's all I'll say about that right now. All right, slide 5 gives you a better picture of the scheme of these lipid-based hormones. Now, notice, first of all, that this steroid hormone, the yellow sphere, is being transported in the blood vessel, as you would expect, because it's a hormone. But it's notice that, first of all, early on, at number 1 in the slide, it is attached to a protein carrier. Why would a steroid hormone be attached to a protein carrier in the blood? Exactly, because steroid hormones, being lipid hormones, are able to diffuse through cell membranes. What is the wall of this vessel made out of? Cells, endothelial cells. The barriers of those cells are plasma membranes. So you can't keep a lipophilic hormone contained within a cell. It can go right through the walls. So you can't keep it in the bloodstream unless you tack it onto something that can't get through the plasma membrane, and those are binding proteins. And so incidentally, you have to use the same mechanism for the thyroid hormones, since even though they are amino acid based, also are lipophilic. So lipophilic hormones in general are transported in the blood by being carried by these binding proteins. While they're bound to the protein, they are useless as hormones. They won't have their effect on target tissues until they leave the bloodstream. But not every single lipid hormone or lipophilic hormone in the bloodstream is bound to a binding protein. Some are, some aren't. All right? Those that aren't are called just free hormones, as opposed to bound hormones. And it's the free hormones, of course, that can make their way out of the bloodstream and therefore make it to the target tissue. As more and more free hormones diffuse out of the bloodstream, that leaves the concentration of free hormones in the bloodstream lower. And that causes more bound hormones to become unbound, to replace those that were lost. So the bound hormones in the bloodstream serve as a reservoir for that kind of hormone that can be used once they are unbound. And that, therefore, increases the half-life of these hormones. The half-life is the time that it takes for the amount of a substance to be reduced to half of whatever its original amount was. So once a free steroid hormone makes its way out of the bloodstream into a target tissue, notice that it, of course, goes right through the plasma membrane. Well, it might or might not go through the nuclear membrane, but it doesn't matter in its effect, really. If it binds to a cytoplasmic receptor, then that hormone receptor complex will then migrate into the nucleus. Otherwise, the steroid hormone will go right into the nucleus and find its receptor there. So the effect is the same, and that's why the two arrows converge, But what that causes is transcription. And remember, transcription is the first of two important stages of protein synthesis. Transcription refers to using the information contained in the nucleotide sequence of DNA within a gene to create a complementary stretch of nucleotides in RNA. And what is that little stretch of RNA called? It's called messenger RNA, or an mRNA transcript. So it's called transcription, which means to write down something, because you're basically looking at the information and writing down your own copy of it that you can take away from the library known as the nucleus. That transcript then, that mRNA transcript, needs to travel out of the nucleus because protein, actually assembling the protein occurs out in the cytoplasm, and it occurs on ribosomes. Ribosomes are the site of the second stage of protein synthesis, which is translation. And why is it called translation? Because you are translating one kind of macromolecule into another. You don't really turn mRNA into amino acids, of course, but you read the information in that transcript and use that information to build a protein amino acid by amino acid. Well, this takes a bit of time. These steps take some time. And that's why, in general, lipophilic hormones have effects that take longer to be noticed. But once they do have their effects, those effects tend to be longer lasting. On the other hand, hydrophilic hormones, which operate via surface receptors, exert their effects pretty quickly. Even though they have all of those steps, they exert their effects quickly, basically because all of those proteins involved in the steps already exist in the cytoplasm. They just need to be activated or deactivated by shuttling around phosphates largely. In other words, those proteins don't have to be manufactured. They already exist. They're ready to go. But despite the quickness of the response for hydrophilic hormones, the effects usually don't last very long. Slide 6 shows you what tyrosine, the amino acid, looks like. There are 20 amino acids that organisms use. Tyrosine is just one of them. But tyrosine, by modifying it in different ways, gives rise to the various catecholamines, which includes dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine, or the thyroid hormones, which, as I already said, are tetraiodothyronine and triiodothyronine. All right, now these ones on the right, these thyroid hormones, are the ones that I said are exceptional because they operate as lipid-based hormones, even though they're not lipid-based, simply because they are nonpolar. Okay, slide 7. Are there any questions, by the way? Remember to stop me if there are. Okay. Slide 7 is an example of a negative feedback mechanism involving both neurons and endocrine. So this is a neuroendocrine reflex again. This one happens to be a specific example, though. When you eat, whatever you eat has to go somewhere. It has volume to it, and therefore it increases the volume of the stomach, for instance. Well, when an organ is stretched, that is deforming its surface. It's deforming its walls. And if that organ happens to house mechanoreceptors that are stretch receptors, then that stretching can be sensed, and that's what happens. The various parts of your alimentary canal or your digestive tract include stretch receptors, and so that gives the brain an indication of how much luminal contents there are in whatever part of the digestive system you're talking about. But it does that through afferent neurons, as we just described in the last chapter. So the stretching of the receptors causes those stretch receptors to initiate action potentials within afferent neurons. Action potentials we're going to talk much more about, but those are the signals that neurons operate by, that they transmit along their length. And that's why the cartoon version of the afferent neuron shows you a longish cell. These neurons are long cells compared to the normal compact cells that you find elsewhere. Well, that action potential, that chain of action potentials reaches the end of that neuron, which is where the neurotransmitter is released from. In this case, it's a neurotransmitter at least because it's synapsing with another neuron. That's why just by looking at the schematic, I know it's a neurotransmitter. It's not being released into the bloodstream, therefore it's a neurotransmitter or neuromodulator. Well, the central nervous system sends a signal through an efferent neuron to the pancreas. Now, cells of the pancreas are endocrine cells. At least some of the cells of the pancreas are endocrine cells. Okay? And so, as endocrine cells, they act as their own sensors as well. That's why you have two arrows pointing to the pancreas. The pancreas itself can directly sense a rise in blood glucose. All right? But the pancreas also is innervated, meaning that it receives input as connected to by neurons. So there's two different routes being taken here, a purely endocrine route, in which case the pancreas is sensing the blood glucose rise immediately. And why is there a blood glucose rise? Because you just ate. And after digestion occurs, absorption occurs. Digestion breaks down the food into individual monomers. In the case of polysaccharides, it breaks it down into monosaccharides, which glucose is an example of. So the blood becomes more highly concentrated in glucose. Well, the pancreas can sense that directly. That's just an endocrine reflex. But it can also receive input from the nervous system, which is sensing the fact that the digestive tract has been stretched. Both of those stimuli, even though they're different, occur as a result of eating a meal. Well, the response of pancreas in both of these pathways, endocrine or neural, is the same. And that's why there's a convergence coming away from the pancreas. Its response is to release one of its important hormones, and that's insulin. Insulin is important because a lot of the cells of the body, particularly skeletal muscle cells, aren't able to take glucose into themselves. So if there were no insulin, eating a meal would still fill the blood with glucose, but that glucose wouldn't be able to be dumped into the cells that need that glucose, because that transport process requires the hormone insulin. That's what it's all about. And so insulin operates by negative feedback because it takes the error signal, I mean it responds to the error signal, which is a heightened, higher than normal blood glucose level, and causes cells of the body to take that glucose out of the blood and put it into themselves, which negates the error signal because that brings the blood glucose level back down to normal. All right, that's just one of the pancreas's hormones. Glucagon is another, which operates basically in the opposite direction. If blood glucose level gets too low, the pancreas can sense that as well, and it responds by releasing glucagon, which tells the liver, once it reaches the liver, to break down its stores of glycogen. What is glycogen? It's a polymer of glucose. It's animals' version of what plants make as starch. When an organism has excess glucose, One thing it can do is to string those glucose together as polymers of glucose and make a more compact molecule for storage later, as storage for use later. Plants do it in one way that makes starch. Animals string the glucose together in a slightly different way to make glycogen. And the liver is a principal organ that stores extra glucose as glycogen. Well, storing it as glycogen takes it out of the bloodstream when there's too much. But when there's too little, then the liver says, okay, time to break that glycogen down into the original individual glucose molecules and spill that back into the blood to bring it back up to normal. That's what glucagon does. So they work in opposite directions, but they both operate via negative feedback, both meaning insulin and glucagon. Okay? So that would be antagonistic endocrine control, really. See what I'm saying? Okay. Slide 8 is about calcium ion control. Calcium ion control is very important. Not only did I tell you that calcium ions are chemical signals that are used in all kinds of cells, but if calcium ions were not used in anything except either the nervous system or the muscular system, both of which they're used in for great importance, then you would be in trouble without calcium ion control because your nervous system would shut down. That would leave you dead. Or your muscular system would shut down, which would leave you dead because you wouldn't be able to breathe. So calcium ions, concentration in the blood is tightly regulated. It can't get out of the normal range or things really go badly for you. And the organ that is responsible hormonally responsible for controlling this calcium ion concentration is the parathyroid glands. There are four parathyroid glands that are only called the parathyroid glands because they sit right behind to or posterior to the thyroid gland. They are not part of the thyroid gland. Para means next to, basically. Anyway, there's four little dot-like structures called parathyroid glands that as endocrine cells are able to sense what the plasma ion concentration is. All right? So if it becomes low, which is bad news, especially for the nervous system and muscular system, the parathyroid glands respond by releasing parathyroid hormone. It, of course, is put into the bloodstream, but its main targets, as you see, are bone and kidney. Why bone? Because bone is a connective tissue whose extracellular matrix is the hardest of all the extracellular matrices except for enamel. It's hard, though, because it's made up of hydroxyapatite. Hydroxyapatite is largely calcium phosphate. So that's good for the hardness of the skeleton, but it's also, the skeleton serves as a huge reservoir of calcium ions. So when there's too many, we can dump those calcium ions into the bone. When the blood becomes too little, it doesn't wait around for you to eat a bunch of calcium ions. It takes it out of the bone. And so parathyroid hormone acts on the bone by increasing bone resorption. Resorption means dissolving part of the bony material, freeing up those calcium ions that are in the hydroxyapatite, and dumping those calcium ions into the blood. That brings it back up to the normal range. Very important. Kidney is involved because the kidney is able to adjust how much stuff it reabsorbs. The kidney does three important things when it makes urine. It filters, it secretes, and it reabsorbs. Secretion at the kidney refers to taking things out of the blood and putting them into the urine. Reabsorption refers to taking things that are in the urine and putting them back into the blood. So if calcium ions are being lost when the blood calcium ion is too low, that's not doing you any good. Parathyroid hormone will tell the kidney, don't keep those calcium ions in the urine, bring them back into the blood, save them for the body. Okay, and then calcitriol is a chemical that leads to greater absorption of calcium through the gut lining, through the endothelium of the digestive tract. We're not very good at getting the calcium that's in the food we eat into our body through our intestines. That's made a lot easier by calcitriol, which is the active form of vitamin D. That's why vitamin D is so important for bones, because bones use a lot of calcium ions. We're a lot better at absorbing those calcium ions if calcitriol is around. Okay? And by the way, I'll just, with my remaining 30 seconds, let me just say that it's kind of a torturous path that this chemical takes. Most vitamins are called vitamins because we cannot make our own versions of them. We have to eat them. Vitamin D is one thing that we are able to make on our own, as long as there's sunlight. So sunlight reacts with your skin to transform a cholesterol-like molecule into a precursor, which is called cholecalciferol. You don't have to remember that name. That then travels to the liver and is turned into another precursor that's called calcidiol. That calcidiol then travels to the kidney, which transforms it into calcitriol, which is the active form of vitamin D. Then it travels to the small intestine, where it helps those endothelial cells transport calcium ion into the body. Okay, that's it.